This episode of the Braving Business Podcast is sponsored by, well, me. I'm PJ Benoit, and I've been in the domestic and international logistics space for over 30 years. If you need any assistance with transportation or logistics, my team and I will jump at the chance to help. Whether it be parcel shipments, e-commerce, pallets and freight, full truckload, international air and ocean, imports, exports, warehousing and distribution, or really anything under the logistics umbrella, we got you covered. For more details, please go to shipwithpj.com. That's shipwithpj.com. Reach out to me there. Mention you found me on this podcast for a special surprise. And one last quick thing. If you enjoyed this episode, please stay on after the show to learn more about the Braving Business Podcast and other great episodes for you to discover. And now, let's get the show started. Well, hello there.
Hello there. A little chilly today.
Why are you cold? You're in Tampa, dude. I'm in Chicago. This is cold. We know cold.
Dude, it is cold in Tampa. I don't know what's going on, but
what is
temperatures
cold
here are hovering around 0 Celsius. I'm going to use Celsius because it sounds better than saying 40 degrees, but right now it's around 55, but it was like under 40.
No, we haven't been over 40 since, I don't know, the 1900s. No, I don't know. It's pretty cold here. I mean, and actually our guest today, Mr. Apurva, he is here in Chicago with me. He knows it's cold too.
Yes, it's probably -5 Celsius here in Chicago right now. But yes, it's cold.
Well, you chose that. I chose Tampa for a reason. I am on protest. I will conduct this interview while on protest, if that's okay.
that's I don't know who you're protesting, but that's fine. Actually, let's get into Mr. Desai. He is a fascinating individual, and I think someone who our audience will love because we love him. So Apurva Desai is a digital technology and media executive, an investor with CFO experience with global media and tech companies in the Silicon Valley, in the Midwest, as well as Asia, including companies such as Yahoo, Intel, video streaming pioneer ViewClip, and Glu Mobile. And as CFO, Apurva has grown and scaled companies from funding milestones to successful mergers and acquisitions, including ViewClip, which sold for over $400 million. Throughout his career, Apurva has led finance, operations, HR, legal, and customer support functions, oversaw international expansion throughout Europe and Asia, and mentored team members into strong leaders and contributors. Like all entrepreneurs who've made it, Apurva's journey wasn't perfect. We will hear about two major M&A events in his career, each with diligence lasting almost 6 months that unfortunately fell apart at the last minute, and hear how the company recovered and changed focus and mindset. Apurva currently leads Sarvian Inc., a CFO and digital transformation consulting company based out of Chicago. He is also a partner at the early stage venture fund Interstate Fusion Ventures and an executive in residence for the Commonwealth Club World Affairs Council of Northern California. And on his spare time, Apurva also teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law as part of the Center for Law and Business Executive Education Program. Last but not least, Apurva is also an expert on the Indian head wiggle, which we're going to find out about. And we're going to hear a very amusing story about how he once wrote an experience that he had and became a Wikipedia reference on the topic. Apurva, we are thrilled to have you on the Braving Business Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Happy to spend some time with both of you. And yes, I am a world-renowned expert on the Indian head wiggle, which I would love to share as we get a little bit further along.
I can't wait to hear all about that. That's worth the price of admission right there. Apurva was telling us before the episode that he's also a fan of the podcast, which I'm truly grateful for. And they particularly enjoyed the episode with Shelley Archambault, which was either the first or second episode of the season, I believe, season 3. Great episode. She's an incredible entrepreneur and CEO.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being a fan of the show, Apurva. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, happy. And just a quick story about Shelley. When I first learned about this podcast, I took a look at you know, some of your episodes and listened to the one with Shelley, and my connection to her, and which made me a big fan of this podcast since you had her on, was, you know, when I was asked to give a list of books to people I've mentored in my career a couple of years ago, my first list were generally all men, all white men. And I realized I need to get, you know, amazing female, you know, entrepreneurs and leaders on my list. And the first person I thought of was her. So now my list that includes, you know, some amazing leaders certainly includes her as well. And I was very much, you know, excited to learn more about her when I listened to the podcast that you had with her.
Oh, that's awesome.
If you're looking for great authors in that space, look up Susan Brady. She's got a couple of wonderful books that I would highly recommend. Let's start with your roots. You know, obviously you have been in technology and media basically your entire career. We'd love to hear what sparked your interest in technology and media, and how were your early experiences, particularly with Intel and Yahoo, how did they shape your perspective on what innovation and leadership look like?
Yeah, so you know, my roots, I'm a son of immigrants from Gujarat, India. I grew up in suburban Dayton, Ohio. You know, I'm a sports nut. I grew up playing baseball and soccer, and was on sports teams at the high school level, which wasn't that common for you know, Indian guys in Ohio, but made me a little bit different. But you know, when I grew up, I didn't know what I really wanted to be. I knew what I didn't like. I didn't like sciences. I wasn't very creative. So somewhat by default, or just circumstance, I ended up as a business major. I ended up majoring in accounting and management information systems. And then that led me onto a path of, you know, different opportunities. But, you know, my story wasn't one of those where, hey, I was passionate about being a business entrepreneur. It just, you know, evolved. And I think that's fine.
Very cool. So you've worked in both large corporate environments and smaller growth stage companies. Can you share a moment when the contrast between those two worlds became very clear and how it influenced your career choices?
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, there's been a natural progression from big to small and learnings from big companies that helped me you know, be influential in smaller companies. So I started my career, you know, in one of the largest companies in the early 2000s, Intel, which was one of the top tech companies there. What I learned there was how large companies, mature companies at scale, how they operate, how they run processes, right? But that wasn't going to be my career. You know, I ultimately took that learning and then applied it to a more growing, evolving company and a adolescent company, if you will. Intel was an adult. I went to Yahoo in the mid 2000s, which was a, you know, very successful company, but it was an adolescent, started to apply some of those learnings of scale to an adolescent company, you know, had an experience there, and then even went smaller to startups where, you know, those were more toddler companies. And then took some of those lessons from an adult to an adolescent to a toddler, and had to be adaptable to kind of understand how you influence in each environment.
So tell us about it. What is the difference? I mean, what did you experience how did you apply what you experienced?
Well, so, you know, I think depending on what kind of big company you're at, you know, some big companies are like, hey, you get involved and you stay in your lane. Right. If you're a finance executive, if you work at Apple, you know, they want you to be the best finance executive or finance professional as you can be. When if you excel there and prove your worth, you're going to continue to progress up in the company. As you move into smaller and more mid-sized companies, you know, you have to be able to get out of your box. Right. You have to be able to show business acumen and ask questions around any part of the business, and you need to be wearing multiple hats. You need to be a utility player at times. You know, as a finance person in a startup, oftentimes in a startup, the two most important functions are, hey, somebody who builds a product and somebody who sells the product. Everything else might fall through the cracks. And a finance person is generally there. You have to be able to report. You have to be able to count, you know, your progress and make sure you're safeguarding assets and so forth. But anything else might fall to that leader. So I've managed customer service in my career at a startup. I've managed printing operations at a company that had printing photo books. So the difference often is that, you know, you have to be able to step out of the box in some of those mid-sized companies and growing companies, as well compared to, you know, a large company where you might become, you know, the best in your lane, and you might be, you know, you might be rewarded for being an optimizer and creating 5 to 10% optimization improvement. In a mid-sized, smaller company, you have to be a builder and you have to tear it down and maybe build it from scratch and be excited for that.
No, very cool. What was Yahoo like during the, was that like the heyday of Yahoo?
It was a little bit after the heyday. Now, what I also learned, Yahoo was an amazing place, right? And if you think of the Silicon Valley, you know, the image of mid-2000 Silicon Valley, where you had the great cafeterias and you had the coffee shops and you had the, you know, the foosball machines and you had Wi-Fi buses that took you from San Francisco to Sunnyvale. We had all that, right? You had oil changes on campus. You had haircuts on campus. It was an amazing experience, right, at that point. Now, what I also learned about Yahoo, what I really learned about Yahoo was how to manage diverse stakeholders. There were lots of different people involved, and how do you herd cats and how do you manage diverse stakeholders? But I also learned about when it was time to leave a company was when you started to, and this happened at Yahoo a little bit for me, which was you started to have to justify why I'm working on this project versus somebody else. And it was all, you know, a lot more political, right? And turf wars. And when you started thinking about internal dynamics like that versus the customer versus the market, you know, it was time for me to move on. But Yahoo is a great learning experience to learn about the internet, learn about internet business models, learn about how applying scale from big companies, like I learned from Intel to adolescent companies, were all things that were great, great opportunities there.
Very cool. Very cool. So I have just off the cuff, I have a question for both of you. You know, you mentioned like Yahoo being a great example of a startup company and you've seen that throughout your career. Tal, of course, you've seen that throughout your careers as well. But Apurva mentioned something that actually I have seen many times in my career, which is internal politics. At what point do you feel a company goes from, you know, hey, everyone's wearing different hats, everyone is, you know, rolling up their sleeves and working towards the same goal, to then, just like you're saying, where things become turf wars, where things become politics? What point is that? And as business owners, how do you, like, what would you do to try to keep that at bay for as long as possible?
I mean, I can start. You know, I don't think there's a definitive answer there. It's not like, in my mind, you get to 200 employees, now politics started, or is it 1,000 employees, etc. You know, I think there is a kind of concept that I've heard in startups where, you know, CEOs often, perhaps up to the first 100 employees, that founder, he or she might have been involved in their interviewing process for maybe every one of those employees. They are very much shaping the culture of that company at that point. And now, you know, as you start to evolve to a point where, you know, the founder is not touching the recruiting process and the hiring process and bringing in new people into the company, the culture starts to change, right? And at that point, can the culture still, you know, it's about that next level of leaders that you have brought in and keeping it focused around the values and principles of the company, as opposed to, you know, other people who don't know the CEO and so forth, trying to say, how do I get in front of him or her? I don't know if that's at 100 employees or thousands, but, you know, once that founder, once that CEO starts to lose his or her touch, I think you start to see people trying to navigate and manipulate their way into his or her good graces, right? And getting in front of them on, I want to work on this project, as opposed to that person.
I would largely agree. I think that there isn't a hard and fast number, nor is there a hard and fast environment that is far likelier to bring about politics than others. I think just about every environment is going to have politics because you're dealing with human beings, and human beings are, you know, inherently political and inherently self-interested. What you want to do is you want to create a culture that rewards collaboration, and that's easier said than done sometimes. But if you are able to recognize team accomplishment versus individual accomplishment consistently and not celebrate a-holes, right? Because in every organization, there are high performers. And in some organizations, those high performers happen to not be very nice people. And what I've found is if you're in a culture where the high performer who's not very nice is not only tolerated by but celebrated, politics are going to be the likeliest place you wind up. And you're going to get a whole array of other issues that are counter to what you're likely to want to accomplish as a founder and CEO. So I would encourage niceness. And I know actually, Apurva, that's something you agree with. I think, you know, one of the quote you gave us is, was about kindness. And ultimately, I think that if you're a CEO and a founder, you may not be able to control, you may not be able to stop politics from occurring, but you can create a more benign version of politics. That's a long conversation probably that we could have on this topic, but that's my two cents on it.
Yeah. And I would add, I mean, I think if there's a culture that you can create that employees feel like this is my company, this is not your company, meaning the CEO or the CFO or, you know, executive management. And they operate in a way that says, okay, what's the best for the company as opposed to just what's the best for me? You start to get a culture that's collaborative, right? You get a culture that recognizes that type of behavior and that type of value system. How do we create that culture, I think, is a big part of the leader's responsibility.
So let's talk about, you know, another key trait for leaders, which is adaptability. And adaptability is particularly critical when you're facing challenges. Can you think of a moment in your career where you were facing a significant challenge and really had to lean into adaptability? And maybe share with us kind of what you went through, your actual, not the business outcome, that's fine, but what was the experience like for you dealing with it?
Yeah, and actually, I think PJ referenced earlier, you know, I've had two situations in my career where I was the CFO of the company and we went through M&A processes where we were being, a target for acquisition. And months long diligence up to 6 months, and basically at the 1 yard line, to use a sports analogy, the deals fell apart. And in one case, you know, the market environment had changed from before when that process started to when it ended. The fundraising environment was much more difficult at the time it ended, and at the time, you know, companies were able to be negative cash flow and still raise money. And now at the end, cash burning companies had a much harder time raising money. So, you know, the adaptability that had to happen overnight was for several months. The focus for me as a CFO was discipline. How do we get through the diligence? How do I, negotiate? How do I identify opportunities for leverage and so forth with the potential buyer? And then when that deal fell apart overnight, we went into survival mode, right? And raising funds was difficult, and had to change the discipline type of mindset, because we were trying to get through a step-by-step diligence process to I got to get into sales mode now. I have to go get our resources in every function from sales to engineering to product operations. I got to get them into margin and optimization mode, margin enhancement, because we have to change our profile to be able to raise funds, right? So that level of adaptability had to happen overnight. It was part of a survival dynamic. But knowing enough about myself, and this is a little bit about also the smaller company dynamic I mentioned earlier, which is being able to step out of your box and recognizing that, you know, I might have become the CFO because I was viewed as, hey, he keeps things moving, he keeps a tight ship, he's organized and disciplined. But now I have to be a salesperson, right? I have to get people who are not thinking about margin enhancement to change. And if we didn't do that, you know, we wouldn't have raised money and we wouldn't have been able to continue the journey that the company was on.
So I've also been on, as CEO, on the side of deals that didn't happen, right? You're going through M&A, once or twice, I was on the buyer side, and I think at least once on the seller side, and deals fall through. And I remember feeling just inside, I felt exhausted. I felt a little embarrassed. I felt anxious. There were a lot of emotions that I went through. And I also felt that I couldn't expose those feelings to my team. Now, you know, it's interesting because I went through these moments in my career much earlier when I was in my 30s and very early 40s. And I think I would be handling those moments differently now. I think I actually would expose my emotions a little bit more to my team. How did you, you know, I'm sure that financially speaking, for you individually, it was not great news that these deals fell apart. For the companies and the employees, not great news. A sense of maybe failure as an individual. What did you feel like, and how did you manage the distance between what you really felt like inside and what you presented?
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, when you're an executive, you have to learn how to compartmentalize. If you're a CEO or a CFO or, you know, in any of the leader roles, and, you know, you have to compartmentalize. Things may sound like everything's going wrong in one area, but you can't convey that when you're inspiring and guiding and leading and motivating a team, right? Now, you also have to decide what's the level of, you know, balance and transparency. Now, of course, through an M&A process, not the entire company is aware of that process. You know, there's a set of core individuals that are involved. But when it drags for 6 months, it starts to become kind of apparent to the company. But I think, you know, in that case, because it took that long, we had known that this is now becoming much, this is known to people who aren't even in the process. So we had to be transparent, right? And the market was known in terms of how difficult the funding environment was going to be. So kind of factoring those types of things, we were transparent on, hey, things are going to be a little bit tougher now. We're focused on raising money, and it's going to make a mind shift from you all, and here's how we're going to get there.
So, Apoorv, I'm going to challenge you because there's nothing wrong with what your answer, but your answer is in the we. You talk about the leadership team. I'm talking about you as an individual. What did you feel like? How did you deal with it? And what did you feel was the distance between where you as an individual, not as a representative, not as a CFO, as a man, as a person, how did you experience that moment? And what could you share with our audience that perhaps haven't been in that moment yet? And again, in all these moments, we are parts of teams, but we're also individuals. And so one of my goals with this podcast is to give tools to individuals to deal with moments like that in their lives and in their careers. Share what it was like to be you. You were the CFO. It didn't work. How did you feel? How did you behave? What was the distance between where you were on the inside and what you conveyed to the outside?
Yeah. So as an individual, as me, there's a sense of, hey, I've let the company down, right? We've got hundreds of people who are, you know, as a CFO, I feel responsible for. We were trying to drive some financial outcome for them, and it didn't happen. And you know, I'm an integral part of that process. I feel like I let them down, right? Now, there's a variety of reasons why something happened. I don't think it was necessarily because I did something, but you have that sense that we let them down. We, and in my case, I let them down. But the reality was, no, I didn't convey that to them as, hey, I'm sorry I let you down. This didn't go through. You know, that was something that, you know, wasn't really going to be helpful if that's the way I was communicating to them. What we communicated was, you know, these things happen. We have an opportunity to change your financial profile. We're going to make our company even in a better state and we're going to have another opportunity, and it's going to be a better buyer, and it's going to be a better outcome. Right now, how do we get there? Let's focus on that conversation. But there was no time to lament that this didn't happen and blame myself more than I would probably already be saying, hey, I let them down. That's just something, you know, it's a feeling that you have. I don't know if this happened again next week, I would again probably feel I let them down, right? But the learning is you got to get past that quickly. And how do we focus on the future is the goal.
Actually, that's a great point. Side note, you guys have both been involved with M&As. I'm more involved with M&Ms, but that's a whole other issue. what is but going on that, Apurva, you really touched on something awesome there. What is a piece of advice? So if you were talking to someone that you just met at a dinner party or you know at the bar, whatever, and they're facing a major professional or personal setback, what advice would you give them?
I mean, I think, you know, if you're prepared, my advice would be, hey, keep preparing for whatever's next in front of you. And if you prepare and do the best you can, the outcome is probably worse in your head than it will be. That, you know, we generally kind of think of the worst case scenario and we kind of have anxiety around that. And we're conditioned to that in many cases. And then how do we get ourselves to think it's not as bad as the worst case scenario is going to be, right? And that if you're prepared and you prepare to the best of your ability, your preparation is going to end up creating an outcome that's not nearly as bad as you're thinking it could be in your head.
Tal, what about you? You've been in a bar. So if someone is
once or twice, yes.
if you just met someone and they're you know about to go through something pretty scary, what's your advice?
About to or going through it, it's an awesome question. I think recently, as you know, I fell off my bike and I cut myself pretty badly, and I was embarrassed by that. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's been biking a lot longer than I, and he said, "Listen, people who bike break into two groups: those who have fallen and those who will fall." So, what I would say to someone who is in the midst of a professional or personal setback is congratulations. I would say congratulations, because this is a moment of growth. If you embrace this moment, if you look at this moment as an opportunity to learn, as an opportunity to grow, as an opportunity to become a better version of yourself, you're going to come out of this ahead. No one who's ever accomplished anything in life has done that without setbacks. So the fact that you're at a setback, you're experiencing one, is a great indicator, particularly if you emerge on the other side, which is up to you, that you're on the right path. So look at this as a great opportunity, not as a woe is me. And I can always tell when I sit down with entrepreneurs and particularly startup CEOs, which I advise, I can almost always tell to what extent they're likely to be able to persevere. I'll ask about setbacks, and the people that tell those stories and they are the victims of their stories are not likely to make it. When they face those moments, it's people who are able to look at those moments as great moments in their careers. And while you're in it, it doesn't feel that way. But if you're able to recognize it, it will become that. If you allow it to become that, you're on the right path. That would be my answer.
Look at you guys. Well, see, and both of you would have gotten your beer's pot for you.
We'll have to do it sometime.
Apurva, let's talk about scaling teams across the globe. So, you know, one of the great opportunities that you've had, and some of our listeners may also be either in the midst of doing that or aspiring to do that, is to build international businesses. And you've had the opportunity to work with businesses in Asia, in Europe, in Silicon Valley. Tell me how leading diverse teams or being involved in diverse environments change your leadership style.
Yeah, so I've been fortunate to manage global teams. When I was at View, which was the media company, the OTT video streaming company, we had operations across Asia, and I managed people in several countries. You know, some of the things that I've learned about managing global teams is, one is be curious about their life. You know, the headquarters is in the U.S. We get a certain stature just by being part of the executive team sitting in the U.S. and people, you know, want to know about our lives who are on my team. But, you know, I think it's important to build that trust by asking about, hey, what's it like to go to school and your children going to school in Singapore? And what's it like when the local elections happen? And what kind of food are you eating? And what are kind of the customs of your life, right? Demonstrating, I want to know about you. I want to know about your life. I think it's important. You know, I was a CFO, which in my role, I always said that meant I was a chief food officer because I got to go to, you know, offices in these countries, and we would go out to have local cuisine in Malaysia and India and Dubai, and I certainly enjoyed the food. But you know, building that trust and sharing stories about you know, my career and my life and some of the you know, adversity types of things as well, to say, look, you know, we're not that different, right? Like you might be a junior accountant in India, and I might be an executive in the US, but I came from similar type of dynamic, and here's how I got to where I might have gotten to, and you know, here's opportunities for you to learn, right? But so I think for me, and then also like when you have some global teams, if we have a Slack channel, right, I tried not to say, okay, let's have an India team Slack channel for the finance team and a US team. Let's have one team, right? So when I'm sharing updates, it's not that I have to share a different story to the US headquarter team versus the India team or the Indonesia team. You know, let's make one team, right? And demonstrate that trust, and then, you know, also give them opportunities not to just be doing maintenance projects, which it might have been 10, 15 years ago. Let's put them on mission critical projects as well, because we trust them.
Well, that's awesome. So you have mentioned that storytelling has been a recurring theme in your work, from creating these global productions at Vue to mentoring entrepreneurs. How do you approach storytelling as a leadership tool, and why do you think that's so important?
Well, I think every executive needs to be good at storytelling, right? Because particularly in startups, and if you're the CEO of a startup or an executive at a startup, you're going to tell the origin of the company. You're going to tell the time when we almost ran out of money, and we're going to tell the time when we didn't get through this M&A, and we're going to tell the time when you know, the board beat us up about this. We're going to tell a lot of those horror stories. And at the same time, we're going to tell some of the success stories. When we got our first big customer, when we got our first big, award at some conference. And that's how you tell the history of the company. And that's how you build culture, right? So you have to be good at telling those stories. You have to be not annoyed that you're telling the same stories over and over, but you are going to tell those stories over and over. And like I said, for me, you know, as I built trust with team members around the world, I told a lot of personal stories, right? I told stories. I told my Indian head wiggle story. They've all heard it. I've told my story about, you know, I could go on about certain stories, right? About airline stories and free donut stories, but they've heard personal stories that get them to relate to me more. And it gets to, you know, a level of trust that then later, you know, they'll go that extra mile for me, even though I'm in the US and they're sitting somewhere in Asia. So I think storytelling is critical for startups. And I think it's critical for building trust and relationships with people around the world.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that, you know, I've had the good fortune of working with international teams for most of my career. And the more personal the relationship, the more human the relationship, the better the professional collaboration. I would strongly encourage anyone that's in an environment where you're working with people that are from different cultures, and even more so if they're literally overseas, to take the time to personalize the relationship. It is not a waste of time. It is going to return dividends I cannot even describe. And I don't just mean professionally, personally as well. I actually just this weekend received the most kind and generous handwritten note from a gentleman that worked for me on a team in India, who just left for another position, and wrote he made me cry. His note was so generous about the impact my approach had on him. And I felt so gratified. It made so much worthwhile. So take the time to personalize things. I think that you're getting some very valuable advice.
And I think, like, in an example, I've had team members in Indonesia, and we're talking about Chicago and the weather at the beginning. They've never seen snow, right? I send them pictures of snowstorms, and it's one of the most exciting things, because they're like, I will never see snow in my life. I want you for the next, every winter, I want you to send photos to me. Whether we're working together, they've asked me to send snowstorm photos to them, right? It's a part of that personal relationship. That is a very fulfilling part of, you know, the experiences I've had.
I think that's awesome. Let's talk about Interstate Fusion Ventures. So you're also in the ecosystem of finding and funding startups, and it's a very interesting era for startups. I'd love to understand, or I'd love to hear, if you're noticing anything new about founders that are getting funded now versus, say, 5 or 10 years ago. And is there any one key piece of advice you'd give someone that's out there trying to raise money right now?
Well, I mean, I think if we're talking about today versus several years ago, right, we 4 or 5 years ago, we did have an environment where they call it the ZIRP era, the low interest rate era, zero interest rate. So the dynamic was capital was more available. Growth was at any cost was somewhat the dynamic and mantra, and profitability and unit economics were, you know, not as important several years ago, right? I think the reality now is founders know that that is not the environment they're in. They have to be able to have a much more disciplined growth. The growth rates may not be as high as they were before, but the interest level and the focus level on how are you managing your cash burn has changed. And I think that, you know, founders today are much more aware of that and cognizant of what is our path to profitability can't just be that I'm going to have crazy volume in 10 years and that's how we get there, right? It's what is our mix of products? Do we have new service lines or product lines? And that mix changes over time, and we have an understandable story of how we get to profitability is a dynamic that is different today than 4 or 5 years ago with the founders that you often interact with today. But at the end of the day, VCs still want to see growth. Growth is a paramount, but there's a bit more of disciplined growth around the conversation.
Very cool. All right, so let's get to the Indian Hedwiggle story, which I'm very interested in. So how did a simple blog post turn into you becoming an expert on the topic, land you on Canadian national radio? And what is your favorite takeaway from that whole experience?
Well, so the background is, I don't know if you're familiar, some of you mentioned you worked with Indians before, but there's this Indian Hedwiggle or bobble where, you know, Indians might, shake their head where most parts of the world might think that means no. In some of the Indian culture, it might mean yes, or it means I understand or I affirm. And my experience was I was on a vacation in Kerala, India, and there was this older gentleman, a laborer on the grounds, decked out in native attire and, you know, looked very worn out. And there were some European tourists who walked by him and said hello, and he didn't respond. An Indian tourist walked by him and waved, and he didn't respond. And I walked by him and I did the Indian head wiggle. And then he smiled at me with the biggest gap tooth smile that you could ever imagine. Right. So I wrote in my blog at that time, which I was, I was a proficient blogger at the time, just writing stories about life. I wrote about that experience. I also wrote about the head wiggle experience in a book called Shantaram. That was an amazing book. And compared those two experiences. And somehow somebody put my blog post on Wikipedia as the reference for Indian head bobble, Indian head wiggle, unbeknownst to me. So, you know, a few months later, the Canadian Broadcasting Corp, the radio, the NPR of Canada, reaches out to me and says, hey, we're going to do a show about gestures, and we'd like you to, you know, we've seen your article, your post, and we assume you're a kind of a world expert on the Indian head wiggle now. Can you come and talk about that gesture, right? And others were talking about the Italian hands and maybe other gestures around the world. So I was living in San Francisco at the time. They set me up at a radio station. I got to be interviewed on this kind of national Canadian broadcast program on gestures, and I was introduced as a world expert on the Indian Headwiggle. And I in fact bought the domain name IndianHeadwiggle.com. I think I own headbobble.com. So I still haven't made that a thriving enterprise, but that's in the plans with my domain names.
That's amazing.
I love that.
That's amazing. So
I love that.
What does it? So real quick, what is it? The Indian Headbobble? Is it like you're saying? You don't know if it's.
I mean, I think it's more of a. I understand. I acknowledge. Right. That's the typical use. But when someone who doesn't understand it, it seems like they're saying no. Right. So there can be confusion. Right. But to me, it's generally I understand. Now, what I've learned about storytelling from an experience like that and other experiences is the best stories are not planned. Right. The best stories are just things happen and just observe. And maybe that's why I was a fan of Seinfeld. But, you know, you can't plan for certain stories. There's no way I was going to plan that story to happen, right? But the things that have happened to me that are my best stories that I've told to employees are things that were crazy travel stories in India or in Ireland that I would have never planned, or, you know, head wiggle stories that got me on the radio. But so just be ready for things to happen. If you're trying to create a story, it's not likely to be your best story, but things start to happen in just your everyday life, and be observant and be ready to, you know, to share those life experiences.
And I think it's lovely and very good advice. And I would add to that, the self-deprecation and just being able to not take yourself too seriously is a great way to come across these moments, these nuggets that will turn into great stories. And these great stories bring people together. Particularly when you're a leader, if you're willing to share a story where you're not the hero of the story, in fact, if you're the butt of a joke, or you ended up somehow, some way embarrassing yourself even a little bit, right? There's something exceptionally humanizing about that that I think leads to better business outcomes. I don't know exactly, you know, I don't have the math formula that connects that to better outcomes. I just know it's true.
Yeah. I would wholeheartedly agree, right? I think it creates just more, the way I might quantify that in a company is I would think I have better retention of my employees. I have created more trust, and, you know, they're not just leaving for another opportunity. They have to decide, hey, do I want to leave that leader, right? And so I would think my attrition rate is a little bit lower if I've created that type of culture in a particular environment.
I would completely concur. Our guest today, Apurva Desai, digital technology and media executive. He's done some huge things for big companies and also helped some smaller companies achieve great things. He's currently running Sarvian Inc. And is a partner at Interstate Fusion Ventures, as well as being an executive in residence for Commonwealth Club and an instructor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. We are so grateful for your time today, sir. It's been a great privilege having you on. Continued success to you, and hopefully we'll see you again before too long.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure to be on the program, and look forward to having those beers with you at some point down the road.
Oh,
we'd love that.
And that's a wrap, folks. Like what you heard, want to support the show? Please follow our page on LinkedIn and Facebook. Visit us on YouTube, and please like and rate us on all of your favorite podcast streaming services. You can also see exclusive content, subscribe for free to our weekly blog, support our sponsors, and soon buy our merchandise at www.bravingbusiness.com. Thanks for being a part of our production, and we'll see you next time on the Braving Business Podcast.